Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bandy. Hello, Bandy.
Hi, Windy.
And our tactics guy, and give me an N, give me an A, give me a C. It's Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
Hello, Windy.
Cheerleading this weekend.
Yeah, cheerleading. So I was on another stag do, paintballing again, and I provided the hilarious costume for the groom, which meant as the best man, I got given the in-house stock cheerleading outfit to wear to paintball, so that was fun. It looks good on me. Yeah,
you made it look fantastic. Very slimming, I thought. So, with all the horrible shit that's happening in the world today, sometimes it's nice to take 40 minutes out of your schedule and get a dose of positivity and inspiration. And this month, I'm delighted to say we're partnered with Humans of Purpose, a weekly podcast with purpose-driven leaders whose work is having a positive social impact. We got a message from Mike Davis, who is an ex-sub. He's also Australian, as is the podcast. And Mike was saying, hey, Windy, have a listen to my pod. I think you'll find that our values are aligned and I think you'll enjoy it. And I'm not going to lie, I tend to get lots of these sorts of messages. Having a platform, people want us to promote their stuff. And often I go and listen to a few minutes of their offering and I realise pretty quickly that it's not for me. This couldn't be further from the truth in this case. I really loved Mike's style. I loved the guests. And I found it really fascinating. The podcast is based around stories of people who carved out careers dedicated to social impact. And Mike, through Mike, we learn from these people about how we can do our bit potentially and find work that aligns to a higher social purpose. And also just to stay informed about what organizations and initiatives are out there and leaders in that space. Mike's guests come from leading charities, social enterprises, purpose-driven businesses, but they also include authors, politicians, philanthropists, and more. In this week's episode, Mike speaks to David Bartlett, who he describes as one of the most inspiring people he's ever met. David tells us in the episode how he's gone from being raised under the care of the state to running the state, being a successful leader across a range of sectors and raising a family at the same time. And he speaks about having a purpose in life and refining that and reviewing it as much as possible as you go. And also about understanding that life is about chapters or seasons and you don't necessarily need to dedicate your whole life to any one cause in particular. There's so much more besides that. It's a really fascinating conversation. And over the next 3 weeks, we'll talk to you about three other episodes of Humans of Purpose that I think you'll really enjoy. I think you'll be inspired to download and listen to them. If you want to do that, go to Humans of Purpose in your podcast player. Just type that in. If you like it, make sure you hit the subscribe button and leave a review. You can also learn more about the show at humansofpurpose.com. And Mike has said that if anyone wants to send him a note to say that they enjoyed the pod or for future guests maybe, you can contact him at mike@humansofpurpose.com. And I want to give a shout out to our ex-sub Rajiv Chabra, who went to his first match yesterday. He said he felt like a little kid filled with excitement and was grateful to the ex-sub family that welcomed him for a pre-match beer. Bardi, you're part of the ex-sub family that welcomed Rajiv for a beer.
Yeah, it was great to meet him. We did a kind of like pre-game prediction and he was quite close. He said 4-1. So he was.
I said 4-1 too.
Yeah, but no one heard you say 4-1, Windy. You just said it to yourself, and then I know what you're like. You just lie or change the terms of it. But he actually said in front of all of us that it'd be 4-1. So, yeah, good on him.
Nice. I predicted 4-1 in the Discord. It was in response to Connor saying 4-0. And then I got called negative for saying 4-1, which I thought was amusing. Nathan, what have you been up to on Patreon?
This week, not a lot. So I'm about to move house, which means that the podcast may suffer for a couple of weeks. I'm going to lose internet access. I've downloaded some set pieces ready to do when I'm offline for a while. And the idea is to do an online thing this week. So this week, I think, I'm going to be doing something on Twitch. I'm going to be doing a two-part thing. The first part I can do on Twitch because there's no match footage involved. And then the second part will be back behind the paywall on Discord and such. So, yeah, I think I'll leave it at that for now.
And how can people find our Twitch?
I believe it is something like twitch.tv/theextrainge.
That is correct. That is absolutely correct.
Did you know that?
I was just testing. I was just testing our boy Nathan, okay. Teasing him. and Bardi, you have been making appearances on national radio.
It was quite unexpected, but you had faith in me, Windy. I was like, you're Emerson Royale. You put me in and thought that I could have a good game, and I'm quite happy with how it went. My mother-in-law wanted to know why I didn't have my face on it. I had to explain to her, even though she's an old lady, that it's radio and faces, you don't tend to put your face on the radio. But it was nice, and they kind of told me to go after Chris Sutton and Robbie Savage, but perhaps I went after Chris Sutton a bit too hard. And that's why he...
You can't go after Chris Sutton hard enough ever, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But I seemed to really upset him, and he gave the win to the Newcastle fan, which was outrageous, to be honest with you.
So this was Gone in 60 Suttons, which is a terrible title for the little part of their 606 show. I actually quite like Robbie Savage. I think he's, you know, dick of a footballer, but he's quite likable as a presenter, although his views are not the best. But so it was like a fighting talk kind of thing, and I thought, there's no one better that I know than the most competitive man I've ever come across, and that is Bardi. He's perfect. But they got your name wrong, mate.
They did. They called me Bandy, which I don't even know where that came from.
They've seen your legs.
It was... Yeah, but the thing is, all everyone remembers now is that I was called Bandy, and yeah, no one, they've all forgotten all my De Niro comments and going after Newcastle and Alan Shearer. Now people only remember Bandy, which is a real shame.
It was brilliant, mate. I was very proud of you. I thought you were magnificent. I liked your Newcastle, the biggest team in Newcastle line. That was excellent.
Thank
very
you.
Nice.
As long as I make you proud. If I make you proud, then I've done
winning that. At life. You can tell, listeners, that we're all a bit hyperactive. We're all a bit excited today off the back of a 5-1 victory. It feels pretty damn good. I'm going to say never in doubt. Now, I know that was not the consensus at halftime. There were a lot of people who were kind of a little down on the first half performance. For me, that is the best I've seen us maintain attacks since Conte has arrived at the club. I thought the way we recycled the ball and kept the pressure on throughout the first half, despite Newcastle defending resolutely and pretty well in the first half, I was really impressed with our play. Really, really impressed. And I just thought it was a matter of time before we got a goal, and then they'd be chasing the game and it would lead to more. I mean, it didn't quite work out that way in the end. But let's start with the lineup. Bardi, Doherty playing left wing back, and Emerson Royale, who you mentioned earlier, brought in on the right. What did you make of that?
I mean, I think I'd be lying to say if I wasn't concerned with the wing backs that started. And even though, like you said, we controlled possession in the first half better than I've seen us do it for ages, I was still worried that we wouldn't get the penetration or the end product we needed from our wing backs. And I wasn't down about the first half. I was really happy we went in 1-1. I think had we gone in at 1-0, then maybe the nerves would have settled in. I was concerned about our fullbacks for sure. I just didn't think they had it in them, and I'm glad to be proven wrong.
Yeah, getting that equaliser was absolutely critical. You know, it changes the dynamic of the halftime team talk. I mean, I didn't think we deserved to be behind. It was a goal from nothing, really, wasn't it? And I don't want to criticise Lloris, because it does feel like we criticise him quite a lot these days, but he surely has to. That's on his side, right? He has to do better with that free kick.
I mean, I put in our running order the defensive wall setup, because they took a long time to put that together.
They did.
And it was I think if you're going to take that much time to put something together in order to protect yourself, then as a goalkeeper, you need to be looking after your side of the goal. And I think Newcastle were very smart the way they positioned their players to block him off. And he didn't see it until late. But I just thought if you're going to take that much time and effort to create a wall, do it better. And I think it's something that they need to learn from.
Mm. But then, Nathan, we pretty much went right up the other end and Son whips in a fabulous ball, which the Welsh Maldini got his head on.
The Welsh Maldini. Yeah, so after the corner, it comes back out to Son, which does kind of point to... I mean, so the thing with the lineup is, like, I was feeling okay about it, you know? I thought that Royale had looked good coming off the bench recently. I thought I'd like to see him get a match alongside Kulusevski, and that would be good for him against a lesser side. I don't hate Doherty on the left, and I think that, again, you saw it. There's this thing where, like, when he takes crosses from the right, he hits them on the run and plays them early. When he's on the left, he has to take the touch mm-hmm. back onto his strong foot. And he has a much better delivery from the left just because of the habits it forces him into. I didn't hate that at all. And I thought that it could have potentially been like a good stock raiser for either one or both of them. And then sort of in the second half, because like it was sort of piling up, right? Newcastle were just completely surrendering midfield to us and allowing Højbjerg and Bentancur a lot of time on the ball. Which I think is, you know, pretty suicidal, basically, in terms of just any kind of football match. And so, yeah, there was a burden of creativity on the wing backs, but I just felt like over the course of the game, even if you don't rate either of these two, they're gonna turn up something if you just mm-hmm. keep letting them have so much time. Which I don't really think is what materialised. What materialised is Newcastle. It's like we talked about before with West Ham. They came out in the second half and decided that they can play football. And there's nothing Conte wants more than a not great team trying to push up and play the ball and commit players forwards and leave space in behind them. So it was complete. Like, I don't think we changed much at all. Maybe we saw more of the likes of Kane, Kulusevski and Son drifting into wing-back zones, which is how we sort of also got the first goal in the first half. But maybe that is just a result of having space to counter into. Mm-hmm. So Newcastle just kind of gave the game away. And I don't really get why, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. The second goal, so Doherty's header from the magnificent Kane cross, comes from Newcastle mishitting a pass out. It was Cher, actually, who'd scored the free kick, mishits a pass out from the back and is intercepted. I think Kane intercepts it himself. But by the time he crosses it, they're back into a sort of 4-5-1 defensive shape. And they look quite, you know, they look quite well positioned to deal with the cross. But such is the brilliance of the ball. The delivery is just incredible. And look, Manquillo doesn't cover himself in glory at the back post, but it's such a good ball. It's going to trouble any defence, frankly. You know, the corridor of uncertainty, as they used to call it, between the last defender and the goalkeeper. It's such a difficult part of the pitch to defend. And Doherty made it count. He sort of stooped in and made it count at the back post. And then the floodgates opened.
Yeah.
I mean, we got the third quickly, right? It's... and the third goal is a thing of beauty. I urge you, if you've not watched it back, go back and rewatch that third Spurs goal. And then any time you hear Spurs fans in the stadium groaning about playing out from the back or risky passes at the back, tell them to shut up and show them a clip of that goal, because it is the perfect example of why playing out from the back, when you're as good as we are, is a good thing to do. It's Dier and Højbjerg and Lloris, they're sort of tight into play and they draw Newcastle onto them. And what it means is that we create spaces that weren't there before, and Kane's able to pass fantastically to Kulusevski, who takes one touch to set himself, really good touch by the way, down the line, looks up, feeds in a lovely ball which Son controls on his left, finishes on his left, and that pretty much is game over at that point.
I mean, it helps that Newcastle's press was pathetic. That really helps us. But to be fair to Lloris, some of his passing was all right on the weekend, but there is always that fear. And you can sense it. I'm sure you feel it on TV as well, but you can sense it in the crowd when we try to pass out. I think for the most of the time we're okay, especially against a team like Newcastle. And I think it was just waiting for them to get tired, because Shelby doesn't move. Willock is all right. He buzzes around, but he doesn't do much. And it was always going to be a question of time. Joe Linton is pathetic. Fraser, Chris Wood. They're a team of like pieces of wood. They're logs, man. They don't move at all. St. Maximum is okay, but he had a bright first 10, 15 minutes. And then once Emerson got his confidence back, it was game over for him. It was just always a matter of time before they opened up, and they pretty much did a West Ham. And it's great to see us not only score goals, but punish teams as well. And I really think the fifth goal is an example of that, of players coming on that want to do something, want to prove something. And they're not just coming on just to make up the numbers and see out the minutes. They're coming on to actually do something. And it's a great moment for Tottenham.
Shout out to Eric Dyer on the fifth goal. Really aggressive front foot piece of defending. Sort of wins the ball incredibly aggressively and then feeds Son, I think. And it ends up, you know, really, really nice finish from Bergwijn from a sort of typical Lucas run, sort of looking like he's bitten off more than he can chew, but actually gets to it anyway and feeds it through.
I mean, you can't fault anybody. I thought everybody played really well.
Mm.
There was the one mistake from Lloris on the free kick. Other than that, I thought everyone had a great game.
Mm.
Perhaps Son could have scored a few more. Perhaps Bergwijn, I think Bergwijn had a wonderful shot. It's been kind of forgotten in all the highlights. And I don't think even Match of the Day 2 showed it. But he did have a wonderful strike, which just went over. And it's a really nice thing to see us playing with confidence and playing with some style and playing with some swagger. And that back three, Romero, Dyer and Davies, looks really good on the ball, off the ball. Romero, he's just something else. And he just keeps growing and improving every game.
He is a ridiculous player. I don't quite know how we've got him. I think he is one of the best defenders I've ever seen. Genuinely, I just think he's marvellous. You know, we've had some unbelievable defenders at Spurs over the years. You know, I'm privileged to have watched Ledley King when I was sort of in my formative years. Well, Sol Campbell before that was a fabulous defender, as much as I hate to say it now. And then King, watching him come through and grow as a player alongside Nabet to become, you know, a leader. And then Vertonghen and Alderweireld, who I think Alderweireld at his peak is the best I've seen at Spurs. And Romero's playing at the moment, you know, early days. At the moment, for me, he's playing at a level even above that. I think this level he's playing at is the best level I've ever seen a defender play at for Spurs. I think he is unbelievable.
Wow. Better than Alderweireld at his peak.
I really think, I mean, because Alderweireld's passing was obviously something special, right? You know, not only was he a great game reader, he was physical enough, and he could ping one. But Romero, so he is not only a brilliant game reader, he's also a shithouse. He's super, super aggressive, but he makes it count. He wins the ball more often than not. And he travels with the ball like Lucas, you know? He's up there with our best dribblers. It's ridiculous how comfortable he is in possession.
He's better at playing the ball after the dribble than Lucas is.
He is. He genuinely is. I think he could play as a defensive 10.
There was a moment, we were already a couple of goals up. There's a moment where he wins the ball with an aggressive challenge and then he stays on the ball. He runs up with it.
Yeah.
And he's looking to make a counter, but there isn't a sufficient runner ahead of him. And he just sensibly holds onto the ball, waits for a sideways pass to open up and just lets us slip into sort of settled possession rather than trying to force a needless counter. I just thought that is so smart, so aware. Because normally a centre-back gets excited in those moments. Like, oh, I'm getting to do some attacking now. But he's so aware, so calm, so...
Mature.
Yeah, mature. Mature is a good word.
I mean, I get carried away with certain things. You guys have known me long enough. And after I saw Ndombele's debut against Villa, I was like, he's the greatest midfielder we've ever had. The greatest midfielder we've ever seen at Tottenham. I got really excited over Paulinho because he was scoring goals. And I thought he was, before Ndombele, going to be our greatest ever midfielder. So I don't want to curse Romero, but he is incredible. And you're right, Windy. He's got everything it needs to become the best defender that we've seen in my lifetime anyway. He's a wonderful, wonderful footballer. He looks good and he plays good. And he's got a little bit of everything from all those players you've listed. And I would even add, I mean, I'm not a huge Michael Dawson fan, but he even has the Michael Dawson enthusiasm just to go and get the ball. But instead of, but he does it cleanly, you know. Michael Dawson was shotgun. Romero's like, he's a scalpel. He's a wonderful, wonderful defender.
So that's the bit I missed in my summary of his abilities. He has that quality that the best defenders do, where it seems like the ball is attracted to them because they're always in the right place. That moment where he makes that diving last-minute challenge is a game-changing moment. The ball's probably going to go in the bottom corner, and he stops that happening single-handedly. And not just that, you know, even before that, he'd made a really aggressive bit of closing down. He knows when to sort of, you know, he knows when it's, oh shit, I've got to do something about this at this moment in time. I've got to deal with it. And he takes responsibility. He just, oh my God, he's so good at reading the game. It's ridiculous. For a 23-year-old centre-back, it is ridiculous. Centre-backs famously mature late. In fact, we have a question on this from Brendan O'Connor, who says, is Romero as good or better than Virgil van Dijk when he was Romero's age? He's kind of thinking whether Romero can be as dominant a player as van Dijk is for Liverpool or has been for Liverpool.
So at 23, van Dijk was or has sort of just moved from Celtic to Southampton. He arrived with a lot of hype and expectation from, you know, my mates, the football nerds. He definitely had some sort of sloppy games and sloppy moments at Southampton, but then he was also like, he was playing under Ronald Koeman. Who else in that run? Puel.
I
don't think he was around for Hughes. No, he was gone before. I'm going to basically claim that he probably looks good at the end under Pellegrino, right? So for him to have looked as good as he did under some pretty poor management in some pretty poor teams, I don't know. It's kind of hard to say because it's in different circumstances. I guess the real question here is, like, is Romero going to continue to improve and step up? And I think that he is simply hitting his peak really early. Because you look at him and it's like, what areas of his game do you want him to improve? Like, where are the areas he can work on? Other than, like, be better at switching to a more passive style when needed. But, like, you almost don't want him to lose his edge. You want him to have that characteristic to his game and say, let's base the team around knowing he's going to be like that. So, I don't know, what do you... I guess you want him to be better on defensive set pieces, but that's not going to, like, you're not going to put him up a tier as a player because of that, right?
Yeah, and I think that's, like, an acceptable weakness for me. Yeah. You know, it's defending set pieces is a team effort. You know, yeah, we're already helped by the fact that we play with three centre-backs, traditionally three of the sort of better headers of the ball in the team. So I think it's, you just don't put Romero on their biggest threat, and you basically work around that issue.
I think the bizarre thing about Romero, I think it's not a case of him improving, it's just a case of him continuing and holding this form. Because I think it's, once you get to, like, how long has he been here now? Say you get to 18 months at Tottenham and he's still performing at this level, then he'll get recognised. At the moment, he still could be, oh, perhaps this is just a good run of form. And it's when we see it over a longer period of time that this is just how he plays. Yeah. I think perhaps the yellow card, he does attract a yellow card. But then, like Nathan said, do you really want to stop him going hunting for the ball and winning those challenges? I don't think so. He's had one sending off, which was in Europa League, not even Europa League, whatever it was, that Europa Conference. And that, I think he probably learnt from that. I don't think he's been close to a red card since then.
Yeah, I think I agree that on balance, you don't want him to change that part of his game. It's really helpful. I completely agree. It's just maintaining performance levels now. You know, the impact that Van Dijk had for Liverpool was absolutely huge, wasn't it? You know, they got Alisson and Van Dijk, and suddenly they're league title winners. That they're incredible.
I think to improve Romero, you improve the players around him. If you give him a slightly better midfielder in front of him, if you give him perhaps a better goalkeeper and better fullbacks, then his level will just increase naturally as the players around him get better. It's like Van Dijk. He went from Southampton, where he was a good player, and then you put him into a Liverpool team where he has better players around him, and all of a sudden you have a superstar defender. And I do think Romero is one of those potential superstar defenders, and you could see him happily playing in a Guardiola team or another team in 3-4 years' time.
So that's a good point you made there, Bardi. And so Van Dijk plays on the left of Liverpool's back four, left centre-back, I should say. And their left back, Andy Robertson, is one of the best left backs in the world. Mm. And Van Dijk's distribution is fantastic, and he often finds Andy Robertson. You put a good right wing back ahead of Romero on the right, and you're going to get even more out of him, frankly. He's going to be the guy playing the pass before the pass.
Yeah.
And that is a very, very exciting thing to have in mind, I think, for next season.
And even the pass into the central midfielder. Højbjerg had a good game, but I still think really he's good. A player that we can upgrade on. But can you imagine if Romero's passing into, I don't know, a Brozovic-type player who could take the ball, spin and do stuff with it? I think you'll see Romero improve even more that way.
So Carragher gave the man of the match to Harry Kane. Having complimented Romero, we'll get it. Carragher loves Romero. You can tell he loves Romero. He's constantly saying, I like this guy. But he gave the man of the match to Harry Kane because he felt that him getting on the board in the second half is what changed the game. You know, pulling the strings, spraying passes. Have you mentioned the pass he made to Son? You mentioned Son's missed chance, Bardi. That was from a fantastic Kane pass. Again, sort of round the corner, over the top. How good did Kane look in the stadium, Bardi?
There's something about Kane's through balls that when you see it in like 3D, the ball's there and it's going out. And then it just slows down and then it just drops. And especially the Sun one, it was in my eye line. It looks like it's going out the pitch, but there's just a fade on it. There's a drop. And I can imagine it's like you go to the Open and you see Tiger Woods hit the ball. And it's that kind of spin and that kind of drop on it. It's an incredible thing to watch. And you're right, he probably was man of the match, but it's that kind of thing that he's just so good now. This is just Harry Kane. So for me, I thought Kulusevski was perhaps man of the match, just because he was outstanding. And it's unfortunately for Kane, he very rarely wins play of the year for us because he's just always good. So you don't notice it. You only notice Kane when he's in a slump or he's unfit. And unfortunately for Kane, that's just the stick that we beat him with. I thought Kulusevski was brilliant, but of course
so
Kane
good.
Was brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, so I tweeted from the extra inch that I think I couldn't think of a player that had an impact, an attacking player that had an impact like Kulusevski right from the start since Harry Kane. And Ben from Wheeler Dinner Radio corrected me. Delhi was the one. He's the last one that had a similar impact immediately on our attack. Kulusevski is seriously special. We've spoken about him a lot over the last few weeks, and of course we have because he's consistently performing. But it's not just the goals and assists, is it? It's his general round play. He's such a smart player, Nathan.
Yeah. I tried before when we were talking about the difference between Kulusevski and Lucas to sort of tone things down a little bit. Because obviously we get some pushback on our criticism of Lucas, but I wanted to sort of be reasonable and get a larger sample and say, look, Lucas does offer us this dribbling sometimes and we need that and there's something else going on. But oh my goodness, it just feels so much better with Kulusevski in the team. We just function so much better in every situation, really. Man, we've wasted some time playing Lucas in our first 11. I'm sorry. I know that's really sort of harsh. We're kicking a player when you're asking me to celebrate another one. But the brilliance of Kulusevski really does bring to mind the number of minutes that Lucas has played in our first 11.
Absolutely levels above him.
He has the work rate and the intensity of Lucas.
Yeah.
And he has everything that Lucas doesn't have. And you're right, we don't need to go in on Lucas, but we should just enjoy Kulusevski. He's got a first touch, which is wonderful. He's got an ability to pick out a pass. He set up the goal with his right foot. He's got a little bit of everything, and he's just going to get better. And I do see him coming central. I just see it at some point that we'll move inside and he will become our third midfielder. I just see that he's not limited to playing out wide and cutting in on his left. He's got a little bit of everything.
I think he's got that kind of Kevin De Bruyne quality where he could play in any position effectively. You know, De Bruyne has played central midfield, both wings and up front this season. And I think Kulusevski could do the same. I think he can make any position work. He's just a quality, talented player.
It's kind of one of those ones where we talk about versatility being a weakness, right? He played a lot of games up top for Juventus and he didn't, you know, bag a bunch of goals and they labeled him a flop. So yeah, he can play up top, but you got to think about what you're asking from. Sweden did the same thing, but then, you know, obviously the makeup of their squad is not that much under their control. I wouldn't want to play him up top too much. And when I do, I want to understand that he's there as more of a kind of a 10 type player with some hold up play. But yes, he's definitely a versatile player. And he can even, you know, do a bit of the wing back stuff here and there. Mm. Sure.
I mean, Juventus not scoring a lot of goals. It's just something Juventus do. They take the one of the best goal scorers at the current time, Vlahovic, and then he goes to Juventus and he stops scoring. So I think it's really unfair that people use that as something, oh, he didn't do anything. And for me, it's a good thing that they think he failed, because we got a really good player for cheap, because this is an absolute steal, the price we're getting him for.
For sure. And on the other side...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Matt B says, is it just me, or is Son seeming a lot more comfortable and effective at picking up the ball deep in Conte's system? And has Conte adjusted to make it work for Son? Seems like he does a lot of quick touches deep and then turns and makes those dangerous runs. And actually, this was something that I picked up on too and was going to talk to you both about. It's something that I criticised Son for earlier in the season, coming deep and having quite loose touches with his back to goal. And it was much improved against Newcastle. But I do think that Matt's onto something. I think the fact is that we are just, as a team, more adept with Conte's system. We know what's happening. And so there's not that moment of uncertainty in Son's mind, which is like, oh, I've got to control the ball and also think what's happening next. It's natural now. He knows what's happening next. So controlling the ball is his only focus. Nice. I didn't think of that. I didn't think of that. I like it. Another Spurs player becomes an ex-sub.
Ooh, are we allowed? Can we talk about that? No? Probably or we just not. Leave that suspicious? Leave that mysterious? Okay. I feel like he's just sort of simplifying what he's doing in those moments. He's not trying to turn in those situations anymore. He's controlling and releasing and then getting back to, you know, maintaining being a threat in behind. I still think like he's still not great in that position, yeah. Obviously, and you can't ask too much. But I do think he's simplified a little bit what he's doing there.
Mm. And I think the understanding of the players off him also helps. If you've got players moving into space and players available, and just simply the pass into Son is better, then it just makes everything easier for everybody.
That's it. I think everything's happening in the right order now because they're still used to the system. And it just feels like a well-oiled machine. It's so good to watch. We look like a really, really good side. Chayla Kin says, why don't we talk more about the similarity or contrast between our fullbacks and wingback system under Poch and Conte? Under Poch, it wasn't exactly the same, but a huge amount was also asked of the fullbacks, and at times we played a back three with wingbacks. I get that Conte might expect more of a creative attacking threat from his wingbacks, and that we were a better team in general under Poch, but what else is different about these two eras of Spurs wingbackness? Any thoughts?
Okay, so under Pochettino, the purpose of the wing backs primarily is to stretch the opposition and threaten them, therefore opening up more space inside for the likes of Eriksen and Dele to combine with Kane and sort of go in through the throat. Whereas under Conte, he's not afraid to just put it out wide and just shell the ball into the box from wide areas over and over again until the opposition can't take it anymore. I was thinking in the game how like quite a bit of the discussion, and it's returning to a question that we've had before in previous episodes as well, quite a bit of the discussion around Conte's use of this formation is the idea that he's like a wing-back orientated manager, but I don't think he is a wing-back orientated manager. He's a back three orientated manager, and the natural consequence is the wing-backs. So you'll see more goals from Conte's wingbacks because their job is to arrive back post as well. I get that. Okay, you've sort of said that in the question that we're a better team in general under Poch. What else are the differences? I guess there's I don't want to downplay it too much. There's a little less physical demand from the wingbacks under Conte. Which again is not to say that that is like not a physically demanding role. When Neame came on, he talked about regularly subbing them off at 60 minutes. But they're not quite having to do quite as many long, long sprints as they had to under Pochettino. And as a result, that opens up the pool of players that we can buy for that role a little more. Because under Pochettino, a lot of the time you're trying to force the opposition to punt it long into the channel, and therefore the wing back has to backtrack and quickly cover that space from having also been using their pace as that threat to stretch the opposition. Whereas under Conte, they can spend a little bit more time just sort of hanging around the opposition fullback waiting for the ball to cross in.
Yeah, my kind of feeling about the Pochettino wingbacks is that they were there to offer a threat, keep people occupied, but then a lot of the time they would like go deep, and then the ball would be pulled back into in that kind of half space for the creative players. And I think with Conte, they're much more of a sword instead of a shield, and yeah, it's just different. It's just a very different style. I do think if Conte had Danny Rose and Kyle Walker, I'd quite like to see what would happen with that. I mean, that'd be quite nice to see.
Yeah, for sure.
Probably a lot of frustration at the quality of crosses, if I'm honest with you.
That's true. Maybe. Although Walker's cutbacks were fantastic.
Both of them developed their crossing game quite a bit during the time that they had the roles.
So I think the fourth goal demonstrates really nicely the difference between the wingbacks under Poch and Conte. So Doherty comes inside and plays a 1-2 with Kulusevski, who's drifted out there. And, you know, as Nathan said, cuts back onto his right foot. And then Emerson Royale has made the run and ends up basically at the near post. That wouldn't happen, at least not very often under Pochettino, because as Nathan points out, they are there to make up the sort of five vertical lines across the back three or four or five or whatever it might be to drag players out and create space for others, Dele, Eriksen, etc. Under Conte, they have much more license to hit the box and make something happen. And in that instance, both wing-backs did that. So Doherty with the cross, Emerson Royale with the finish. And I can imagine Conte was sort of very smug about that moment. I imagine he loves those moments where both wing-backs are involved in a goal.
It was a really nice moment, that Royale goal. It was he gets a lot of stick, and this one performance doesn't make me think that he's the solution at right wing back, but it was great to see him score that. And also it's great for the kind of the continued progression of Doherty, who they're two players that we've gone after a lot, I've gone after a lot, and it's great to see them performing.
Yeah, I think Emerson Royale is not the solution, but he's also not the problem. He's an adequate player who is a much better fullback than wing back. I think he will be moved on in the summer. I think that makes sense from his career perspective also, and it certainly makes sense from our perspective in terms of getting a square peg for the square hole. Akrabons, I'm going for that as the pronunciation, contacted me already. He's got a question for you, Nathan. He says, what do you make of Lisandro Martinez from Ajax? He's a left-footed centre-back and he's forming a great partnership with Romero in the national team. What's his profile like, and could they potentially be the Argentine Jan and Toby?
Ooh, I didn't think about the fact that he plays with him for Argentina. Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, I mean, for Ajax, he is sensational in his ball playing. Okay, so Ajax play with a number six, Alvarez, who is he's what Bardi thinks Højbjerg is. He's a cement mixer. this is despite the fact that they are all about obviously playing the ball. So because of that, not very much football happens around him, and so they have to play out through the wide areas, through the fullbacks, and direct from the centre backs into more advanced midfield positions. And Martinez is a very important part in like maintaining the ball under pressure and managing to progress the ball without ever really using much of his immediate midfielder. His defensive profile, I feel like he's a somewhat more passive. I mean, everyone's more passive than Romero, obviously, but I feel like he's more of a cat. I'm not certain on that. Let me see how that looks statistically.
Yeah. FP Ref says much the same. I mean, so okay. Very, very 99th percentile for tackles, but 8th percentile for blocks, 13th for clearances, 24th for aerials won. So he's more cat-like, judging by that. But yeah, his distribution is absolutely out of this world, according to the data.
I mean, I don't know why you're signing this guy to replace Ben Davies, who is the best left-sided centre-back in the world. So maybe if he's willing to be Ben Davies' understudy, then I'm all for it.
Did you give Gentle Ben's goal an extra loud cheer, Bardi?
Well, I didn't know who it was at first. I thought it was Romero because I was at the other end. But when I saw it was Ben, it did make me clap a little bit harder.
Decent header, to be fair.
Lovely goal. Absolutely lovely. First ever goal he scored at home as well.
Yeah. And was it his first goal for 4 years or something?
Maybe. Last one I can remember him scoring was maybe one against Huddersfield or Newcastle.
So we spoke earlier in the season about Davis finding himself in the box more and more. Not just from sort of open play, but from set pieces and sort of him being trusted as one of the key attackers of corners now, which wasn't a thing back in, you know, when he was playing left back. He was sort of normally left back. He was left back in the defensive phase from a corner. Now he's very much seen as one of the key threats, and he's doing a pretty good job of making a nuisance of himself.
I have Martinez down on my left centre back sheet as a dog cat. So, a somewhat balanced defender who leans more towards aggression but isn't all out anything like Romero. I don't think you would want to bring him in as someone who could cover both left and central. I think we'd be looking at him solely as a left-sided Ben Davies, shadow exister, obviously. I don't think he'd be that cheap. What is his transfer market value looking at? Yeah, they're looking probably up in the 30 to 40 range. It really depends on how much you feel like you need to replace Ben Davies or upgrade Ben Davies versus other possible things you need spending money on. But yeah, I like Martinez for sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm sold.
Okay.
This was an interesting question. Frank Polach says, I was wondering if the three of you have any restrictions, limits or boundaries that you set yourselves, whether you feel you have a healthy relationship with football social media, if it affects your attention span and impacts on other things, and whether Windy, who as I understand it is more or less off Twitter, might have a different perspective on this. Bardi, how about you? Do you set yourself limits?
No, I perhaps should, but I don't. But I have found since I started muting aggregator accounts and people that create content which isn't even there, I live a much happier life on Twitter. So I don't read, I don't receive, I don't see any tweets now which comment or focus on what Conte said after pre-match, after match, post-match, which I'm very sorry for. I beat journalists who do a very good job, but I'm not interested in that kind of hype now. And just have a much better life with it. Do I set myself limits or boundaries? Not really, but I do tend to stay off social media if we lose. That's about it, really.
How about you, Nathan?
I probably have a somewhat unhealthy relationship with social media. I mean, you mentioned attention span in the question. I am as yet undiagnosed with ADHD, but I'm extremely confident that will be my diagnosis eventually. And as a result, like, Twitter and ADHD is like a hell of a combination because the way that they feed into each other is something else. So no, I think I'd have a very hard time trying to set boundaries like that, with Twitter. I think the only thing that I'm really concerned about though is that, like, I will commit too much time to an argument that doesn't matter with someone in my replies, is that I will just go back and forth in a looping, stupid conversation where neither party are particularly interested in hearing what the other has to say and just trying to score points, because that is a negative facet of my personality that I can't move on from. And I am determined to win every argument with everyone who comes into my replies, basically. Other than that, I don't feel particularly damaged by Twitter, but I am on there too much. I for sure.
Yes, me too. Not so much football Twitter. Football Twitter and I are getting along just fine at the moment. And when I say football Twitter, I mean not like actual football Twitter, which is a horrible hellhole of a community. But you know, tweeting about football is just fine right now. I find what really helps for me. So recently, I've been watching a lot of Spurs matches using Sky Go because I'm at my partner's house and she doesn't have Sky. So I'm watching my laptop on Sky Go and it's delayed a bit. So I put my phone over the other side of the room so I don't find out about goals earlier. And that really improves my enjoyment of football. So I kind of, at halftime, I go and pick up my phone and I have a look on Twitter and I might tweet something and have a look at the Discord and I might message in the Discord. And that's really nice. That's kind of suiting me very well. My problem is like I use Twitter for politics and news as well. Not tweeting, just reading. And I'm definitely in the Nathan camp of having an unhealthy relationship. I probably do need to start addressing it because I struggle to watch a TV program now without having my phone in my hand. Doom scrolling at the same time as watching TV shows. And I'm constantly having to go back a couple of minutes to catch up on what I've just missed. I don't do this in my partner's presence. She would find that incredibly annoying. So I'm much better behaved when I'm with her. Maybe I need to kind of, change my behavior a little so I'm less addicted. But I certainly recommend not looking at Twitter whilst the game's actually ongoing. It really enhances the experience for me.
Wish I could, buddy. Wish I had control over that.
No, I remember, when Mourinho was in charge, I was on Twitter the whole time. Because I was bored. The game was boring me, so I was on Twitter. And it was miserable.
I was also, the problem with that is everybody was at home for those games.
Yeah.
There's more tweets, yeah.
Yeah, there's more tweets happening. Now there's 55,000 Spurs fans at the game. Plus there's people out and about getting on with their lives. So people are naturally missing matches. And it's just diluted it a little bit. It's not quite as intense as it used to be. Even when we lose, it's still not quite the end of the world thing. And I think that's just because life has just started again. Whereas before, during lockdown, football was all we had.
I remember when we were at Wembley, if I wasn't at a match, Twitter would be pretty quiet.
Yeah.
So, Alistair Gold has reported today that we are being strongly linked with Sam Johnston, the West Brom goalkeeper. He would come in on a free transfer. So, we're told that Paratici's favourite type of deal is a deal that costs very little. Johnston is the end of his contract. He's been in England squads over the years. He's seen as a sort of fairly competent, reliable goalkeeper. He would be coming in as a backup to replace Gallini. Bardi, as our goalkeeper expert, do you have any thoughts on Johnston?
I mean, now I've heard a little bit more context around it, I'm going to relax a little bit. Nathan was like, do you have any opinions? And yeah, he's not very good. But as a free transfer and as a backup, I think it's a smart move. He's English. He's got he counts towards homegrown, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And he's okay. I would feel pretty confident with him starting cup games and if we're in European matches, especially much more than Gallini. He's not going to replace Lloris, but I think as a backup goalkeeper, this could be pretty smart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's how I feel as well. The only thing is, Brandon Austin signed a new contract this past week, and I don't understand why Brandon Austin would have signed a new contract with Spurs unless he was going to be backup. I mean, maybe, I don't know. Spurs' young goalkeepers seem to keep staying until they're 23, 24, which is madness to me. But maybe Austin still will be third choice and maybe he'll be loaned out. And this is just a case of preserving value or whatever. And Johnston's the real backup choice.
I've never seen Brandon Austin catch a ball, so I don't know. I don't know if he can, but I think, it doesn't make any sense to me either.
We ought to just give a couple of minutes to the World Cup draw. I think it's, I'm cringing as I talk about it because I know that Bardi's probably absolutely seething inside. But the ex-subs are pretty excited. So our ex-subs, we probably have about 40% American ex-subs, I would say. Maybe a little less than 40%. But the fact that England and the US have been drawn in the same group is very exciting to everyone in the Discord, except for the Irish folk, who I guess they'll be... maybe they'll enjoy the lack of stakes for them, but it'll be very annoying for them in the meantime. And Bardi, I assume you're supporting anyone but England here.
Team USA, 41% of everyone in Discord is now Team USA. I mean, I think me, the Swedes and the Irish maybe we're going to hire a log cabin in 25th of November and just disappear for a few weeks and let you guys get on with trying to bring it home.
I heard you say on Gone in 60 Seconds, 60 Suttons, that England have a very good team.
They do have a good team.
So it's the best league. I mean, it's the best league in the world, I think you said.
I mean, I have to win my argument, I have to say a few things. the Premier League, I was, because you need context around this, I was saying that Alan Shearer was scoring goals against against pub players, against the likes of David Unsworth and Jason Cundy and those kind of players, where Harry Kane is actually scoring goals against the elite of the elite at the moment. The Premier League, without doubt, has the best players in the world, isn't it? So what Kane does now, one of Kane's goals is probably worth 0.75 of Alan Shearer's. So that's what I was saying. And the England team is good. I mean, you came semi-finals in 2018, runners-up in 2021. You're on course to probably do the same again, and if you don't, then it's you failed as far as I'm concerned.
I'm quite excited about England's chances. I think even in the short time since the Euros, we have sort of moved on a bit. So Grealish is now a starter for England, which is, you know, before he was a sub. And I think Bellingham might now be a starter as well, given how well he played in the international break just gone, how well he's played for Dortmund. I think Rice and Bellingham could be a viable midfield for England. And you know, those two moves, I do think upgrade us a bit. They make us more dangerous. I'm looking forward to it.
Bellingham, I really like him as either a 10 or the most advanced in a 3. In the midfield 2, I'm like, I don't think that's the best role for him. We have such an absurd like depth of quality across sort of our attacking midfield area,
yeah.
That I guess he sort of gets pushed deeper into what is probably our weakest spot, which is our number 8s. Yeah, it's a ridiculous squad. And the fact that like Bellingham and Grealish weren't seeing the team before is kind of silly, but there you go.
Does Mason Mount help alleviate some of those fears? Because he kind of naturally ends up in midfield a lot of the time.
Sure, I guess. And then his defending from the front is strong too.
Mm. Interesting group for sure.
Like politically.
and yes, politically an interesting group. So once more, do check out Humans of Purpose on your podcast player. And if you like it, make sure to hit the subscribe button and leave Mike a review, or you can learn more about the show at humansofpurpose.com.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud, E. Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.